All right, so if you have your Bibles, we're in Exodus, the 17th chapter tonight. We're not going to completely go verse by verse over these next two chapters, really. It's very familiar stories. Perhaps we're going to look at them in a bigger picture with things. There will be some verses that we really break down and analyze, but it's not going to be really of every verse of the whole chapter type of thing. Last week, though, we began to see that God is taking care of his people in multiple ways, right? They complained about the most basic needs. We all get hungry, right? We all get thirsty. So we saw that God blessed the people with water. Moses cut the tree down and it caused the waters to not be bitter anymore, right? And how did God provide for their food? What did he give them? He gave them manna in the morning, that type of bread, right? And quail in the evening. So he provides for them not only one meal a day, but really two meals at a minimum that we read of. And even on the Sabbath day, the day before the Sabbath, he gave them a double portion, right? So that they were even taken care of upon the Sabbath. And we talk about how the Sabbath was that day of rest. It's really the first institution of that day and being instituted to these people to follow. And did we see that God takes the Sabbath seriously? Right. When those people went out on the Sabbath to see if there was anything left, did they find anything? No. And what was God's response to Moses when he saw these people had gone out?
How long you disbelieve me? Yeah.
How long you disobey me? How long are you going to test me? And we're going to see it's going to go even a step further in chapter 17 when Moses is going to tell these people, you are tempting God with this. So let's talk about chapter 17 in a nutshell. What's occurring here? What's our setting with these people in Exodus 17? What's going on here?
For one thing, Moses listed all their troubles and trying to solve their problem.
Right.
Himself.
Yep, we're going to find that out with Jethro, specifically in 18.
And then, of course, the father will come give him advice how to better take care of them.
Right.
Water.
Okay, they're thirsty. They're wanting water. And I think this time there is a genuine concern with these people. Now, did they have availability to kill livestock and eat it as we talked about in last chapter? Yes. But can you make water? Can you, with the belongings they had, could they produce water in any way? Did y'all hear that?
It's me.
Okay. You good? All right, make sure nobody's defibrillator is going off or anything. There you go. Get up. No, I'm kidding. So, these people are thirsty. There seems to be a genuine concern with their thirst. And that's a fair statement to make, isn't it? These people are in the desert. What's the first thing that you usually run out of in the desert?
Water.
And so they are thirsty, but God is still going to provide for them, and they're just very impatient with these things. And again, they're going to bring up that phrase, did you bring us out here to what?
Kill us.
To kill us to die. And the short-sightedness of these people really takes place in this chapter. Let's just see what Moses responds to them at here. In verse 2, so Moses said to them, why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord? And the people thirsted there for water, and the people complained against Moses and said, why is it you have brought us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? And you see Moses' frustration there in verse 4, where it says, so Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, what shall I do with this people? And they are almost ready to stone me. So, once again, we see our three groups of people here. We have the Hebrews, we have Moses, and then we have God. And they're all frustrated at this point. How does it describe the people and what they were doing, what Moses said they were doing to God?
Testing him.
Okay, can God be tempted? God, spiritual God, can he be tempted?
No.
So is Moses saying that they are testing God to sin here? Is that what that word's meaning here? They are testing his patience and his durability with them and his long suffering. There is not tempting God to sin. Man cannot do that. God cannot be in the presence of sin. We know that. But they are testing God. At times, do you think God was ready to get rid of these people? Yes. Moses goes and pleads for them, doesn't he? I would argue that God is, his patience is starting to wear thinner and thinner with these people. Would you agree? He's done all these things for them, but yet they continue to complain, continue to say, you just brought us out here to kill us. What, do you really know what you're doing? So, not only are you going to kill us, but you're going to kill our animals as well. So what is God's remedy for this? What is he going to do for the people here?
He's going to provide them water.
Okay, he's going to provide them water. But how is he going to go about doing that? Okay, he's going to bring it out of a rock. We've seen some miraculous things so far, haven't we? Now, is it uncommon for water to come out of a rock? Is that very common? It's more common than you think it is. If you're ever in the woods, and where I live, there's a lot of bluffs and cliffs. And we have a lot of springs that will run out of those rocks. But if we had a single solo boulder, you would not. Well, if you hit the rock, you'd say, well, that's solid rock, right? You wouldn't hear splashing around it. And I'm not telling you what this rock looked like. I have no idea what it looked like. It doesn't matter what it looked like. What's the point of the story here? God will provide. That is the essence of this whole book. God's going to provide for his people. He's not going to let them suffer to an extent where they perish completely from physical things. Now, I tried to break it down this week, and then the math got too above me to do it. But I figured if you had, and you all can figure out this later, mathematicians. If the human, let's say the people, I don't know how long they stayed here, but Moses hits this rock, right? God tells him to hit the rock. First off, we need to make that point. God tells him to strike the rock, and water comes out from the rock. Now, would this have been a small stream that came out of this rock? How many people are we dealing with here? Hundreds of thousands, over a million people. This is a large quantity of water. And if you figure just a cup of water you drink is 8-10 ounces, obviously these people would have needed more than that. So let's just call it 20 ounces to be fair. If every single person just consumed 20 ounces, and you're dealing with millions of people, we're talking about, I'm not going to say a number because I'm going to be wrong, a large quantity of water here. This is going to be some type of river or stream this creates. And more than likely, this rock was at a higher elevation where it would be able to flow down into the valley where these people were. This would have been a magnificent sight. This would have been Old Faithful on steroids, really. And water just coming out everywhere for these people. Not only the people had to drink, but what else had to drink? The livestock. And there's probably, honestly, more livestock than people. I would make that argument. This is a huge amount of water. Now, I don't know how long they stay here. The Bible doesn't tell us that. But it wouldn't have mattered if God wanted them to stay there for an hour or for the next 40 years. He would have provided the water from that rock. Now, go over to Numbers 20. We're gonna parallel these passages tonight for a minute. Over in Numbers 20, the people have been wandering for about 40 years now. They're nearing the end of their journey. We're going to see in Numbers 20 and 21 that Miriam passes away, Aaron has passed away, and Moses is about to pass away. But in Numbers 20, there's an event that occurs here. And that is, the people are once again thirsty. So what is God going to do for them? He's going to provide water. Out of a rock. Okay. Look down in verse 2 of Numbers 20. Now there was no water for the congregation, so they gathered together against Moses and Aaron. They gathered against them again. Nothing's changed in 40 years, all right? They haven't caught on to it. They're going to complain to Moses and Aaron once again. And the people contended with Moses and spoke, saying, if only we had died when our brethren died before the Lord. Why have you brought up the assembly of the Lord into this wilderness, that we and our animals should die here? And why have you made us come up out of Egypt to bring us to this evil place? Is it not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there any water to drink? So Moses and Aaron went up from the presence of the assembly to the door of the tabernacle of meeting. And they fell on their faces, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. That first section of verses, could you really copy that out of there and place that into Exodus 17? It's okay. Not, yeah, we're not to the instructions yet. But that first couple of verses there, the people are thirsty. They contend with Aaron and Moses. Have these people matured any, it seems like, spiritually? No, their doubt, who is their confidence still in? It's in themselves and man. It's not in God here. They go against Moses and Aaron. They complain to him. They did the same thing back in Exodus 17. But what does Moses do? He goes to God again. This is why Moses is their leader. Moses is going to go to God for the help with things. Dan.
You do see a maturity of Moses, or he's used to dealing with them, because here he doesn't lose it this time.
Well, yeah, he's about to lose it.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, his initial response to them, he has this patience with them, in the fact of, instead of just, you know, saying, why, you know, right there, then he goes to the tabernacle to speak with the Lord there.
So water comes from the rock in Exodus 17, right? What does God command Moses to do in Numbers 20? God told Moses in Exodus 17 to take the staff that which you struck the river with in Egypt and do what to the rock?
Strike it.
Fast forward 40 or so, 39-ish years or whatever, to Numbers 20. What is God's command to the rock then?
Take his staff.
Hold on. Somebody wants.
Take his staff, but he is to talk to the rock.
Okay, speak to the rock. Does Moses do that? He does not. What's he do? Okay. Now, let's picture this. Moses, we just bragged on him for going to God about things. But he's a man too, and he's going to disobey God in this. He thinks back. No doubt, would Moses have remembered the events of Exodus 17?
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. That would not be a scene you would forget.
He's recording them.
Okay. Even better. You remember things even better when you write them. So, in Numbers 20, he goes, okay. He no doubt hears God. God speaks to him. But he goes to the rock and he goes, well, we're going to do the same thing we did 30-something years ago. Go up, hit the rock, water will come out, the people will be happy. Moses smacks the rock with the staff. Does anything happen? He hits it one time. Does anything happen?
No,
nothing happens. So really, Moses is in a sense of, he's frustrated, he's angry. So what's he do again? Well, I didn't hit it hard enough the first time. He hits it again. Does God grant them water? He does. But what's the consequence for Moses?
He doesn't get to go into the promised land.
He doesn't get to go into the promised land, Mike.
Not only that, Lord is, he talks to people and says, listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water?
Okay.
He's giving himself the glory here. So, I think the leader is Moses there.
That could be what he's saying there. His attitude.
You look in verse 12, that's why God criticizes him for, was because he didn't sanctify him in the eyes of the people.
He says, you didn't believe me. Well, if God and God had said, if what did God, what was God's command to do? To talk to the rock. What did Moses do?
He struck the rock.
He didn't believe him. He didn't obey him in this matter. Barbara, are you going to say something?
I was going to say, mine reads, because you have not believed me to treat me holy in the sight of the sons of Israel. So I think that is why God was denying him the land of Canaan, because he did the people treat God holy in this situation.
Okay. Turn your Bibles over to 1 Corinthians 10 now. Let's go over there, and we're going to see the Bible, the one continuous story, and all the connections that are made here. The 1 Corinthians 10 is a passage that has brought a lot of debate up, a lot of questions about things. 1 Corinthians 10 gives us a little more insight to this possibly too. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 1. Start reading there. Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud. All passed through the sea. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. All ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered into the wilderness. So let me ask you this. What's it saying there in verse 4? It says, for they drank of the spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. What's Paul saying there? And this is there's a lot of thought behind with this too.
I think Christ was with them. God and Christ were with the Israelites on that journey.
No doubt. God led them through there. Jude 3 tells us that the Lord was the one that was with them throughout the journey.
Well, there's also the whole idea of the coming of the Messiah. We already see that. We see it here in place. Really, it was in place even before this, but we see a glimpse of it here. And if Christ is the rock, and God commands us to speak, commanded Moses to speak to the rock, but he struck the rock.
Okay.
I mean, there's some foreshadowing there also.
All right, I think there is some symbolism with this too. How many times did the rock need to be struck the whole time in the wilderness?
Once.
One time. All right, let's say Christ is the rock here. That rock. Did water come out of that rock? Was there life within that rock for the people?
Yes.
There was. Now, ultimately, talking about Christ Jesus, that sacrifice that was made for once and for all have living food through that. We looked at that last week, right? The difference between the manna and the living bread that came from heaven, which was Jesus, right? So let's say Christ represents this rock here and the symbolism Paul is talking in. Christ was only to be struck once, died upon the cross one time. There was no need to strike it later on, too. And many people have made that connection. I've done a lot of study on it, back and forth. I'm not going to say Christ was that actual rock. I'm not going to go out on that and say that. But I do understand the symbolism that is there with it. But Christ was with these people. The Lord was with these people in guiding them through this to this land. But the point of this is, Christ is more sufficient than that rock that they had in the wilderness. Because what did Jesus tell the woman at the well that was trying to gather water? He was the living water. You drink of this water, you will never... Well, what's she doing is she's pulling this bucket up. What is she... She wants that. Yeah, I don't have to do this, right? We were talking about last week. But Christ is the living water. And talking about a spiritual thing here. But there is representation with Christ in these books. Now, you want to go into a real rabbit hole. Here's another discussion. Some will say that the rock that was in Numbers 20 was the same rock in Exodus 17. Now, geographically speaking, that can't be correct. But some will take 1 Corinthians 10:4 and say that rock literally traveled with them, a physical rock. That's a big, big stretch there, okay? First Corinthians 10:4 is a symbolic thing. It's not talking about a rock that traveled with them. And there are people who will talk to you blue in the face saying that was a rock that went with them. It started with an old Jewish tradition of that. But the point is, Christ is more sufficient. And the water and food that comes from him is for eternity.
I mean, the reality is, it wasn't a rock that gave him water. It was God. God gave him water. I mean, if you want to say Paul is speaking about, the deity of Jesus, I mean, you could say that.
Right.
And that may be exactly what he's talking about. But definitely, he's making some parallels compared to they grumbled and tempted God and tested him. And he's telling these Corinthians, don't you do the same thing, but Jesus was there. Jesus was there. He was the one giving them water.
It's the same thing Jesus was telling the people over in John 6 about how, yes, your fathers ate of the manna, they drank of the water, but what happened to them?
They died.
We're talking about a spiritual healing now, a spiritual life that I'm bringing to you. And you're right with that, Joe. So here's where we're going to fall in tonight. I'd like to finish chapter 17 real quick. There's nothing real, real big with it as far as time we need to spend. But there's a very important fact here. The Amalekites are going to attack the Hebrews. This is the first real enemy they encounter along the way. Originally, when God had brought them out of Egypt, remember he took them away from the Philistines because the Philistines were a people of war. He said, we don't want to go this way because if we do, the people will see these giants of war and they'll be scared and they'll run, right? They need their confidence. But now the Amalekites have sought out the people of Israel. And in fact, they do so in a really, really dirty way. Gold star. Here we go tonight. Ready? Who's somebody got it over here last week, I think. Amalek. Do you know who he was related to? Who his granddad was?
Goliath.
Not yet. Goliath later on.
He had to come from Esau,
wouldn't he? He was from Esau. Yeah, gold star, Andy. Good job. You got the prayer, gold star, Andy could teach class Sunday.
What's that?
Second's first loser. So, Amalek was the grandson of Esau. Genesis 36:12 tells us that. But the Amalekites, they seek out these Hebrew people. They hunt them down in a sense. And does anybody know where how they attacked them?
From the rear guard.
Yes. Over Deuteronomy gives a really good account of that. I think we should turn over there and look at that real quick before we move on. But there's a reason God is going to literally have a hatred for the Amalekites. And he is going to wipe them away. In Deuteronomy 25, verse 17 is where we'll start at. Verse 17 and 18 says this. Remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you were coming out of Egypt? How he met you on the way and attacked your rear ranks, all the stragglers at your rear, when you were tired and weary, and he did not fear God. Wow. That's pretty low, isn't it? What type of people, who would have been in the back?
Women and children.
Okay. Women, children, but who else?
Elderly.
The slower travelers, right? This would have been the weakest spot to take over. Now, they go to war with them. This is the first real battle we're going to see. And who's going to fight this battle for them? Who's going to help them through this?
Joshua.
We see a new character emerge, right? His leadership role is beginning to form. But who else is helping fight this battle? God is. And says, Moses, Aaron, and Hur, they go up on this hill, right, to see it, to overlook it. And somebody describe that scene for me. Most of us know what happens here. If someone were to look up on that hill, what would they have seen?
Moses with his hands upraised.
Okay. Now, who's there with him? Aaron and Hur, right? Did I say Hur? Is that the right person?
Yes.
Okay, Hur is thought to be possibly a brother-in-law of Moses, possibly Miriam's husband. That's something I read. Not going to put it in stone or anything, but that is an interpretation there with that. Now, why would Moses' hands have been in the air? Would he have just gone up there to stand and put his hands up? Was he signaling for a touchdown? What was he doing? Holding his rod. What else do you think Moses was doing there? His people are in a battle. He's watching them fight for their life.
To God.
He's praying during this time. Now, when Moses' hands would go down, what would happen?
They would start to lose.
Are we doing one or two bells tonight? Two bells still? Okay. When his hands would go down, the Amalekites would start to win, right? When his hands would go back up,
they would prevail.
The Israelites would start to win. Now, here's a couple takeaways from this. What happened to Moses' arms eventually?
Tired.
Sometimes I make the kids do a little punishment in my room when they don't want to behave. We do wall sits or push-ups. And the kids that can't do push-ups, they do wall sits. And one of the things may or may not be, you got to hold your book out while we sit there and talk for a minute. And their arms get a little tired. But you know what? We don't have any issues after that. things get done. So, Moses' arms get tired, right? Who's there to help support him? His brothers are, right? So what's that mean for us? We got to support each other. We have to help each other spiritually in our prayer, too. Now, just because Moses was praying to God, does that mean all the everything was going to go well and swell on the battlefield? Or do the people still have to fight? We can pray for things, but if you're not willing to fight for them and work for them, that's not sufficient enough. We're praying for it, and that's great. But you got to be willing to put in the work as well. Joshua still had to fight while Moses was praying. And so, but God's with these people. Their water needs are met. They win in this battle. And they end up, look in verse 15. And Moses built an altar and called its name, "The Lord is my banner." For he said, "Because the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. The Lord is my banner." Who did he put his confidence in at this time? God. He was representing him, right? Proud of him because he'd done all these things for them. It wasn't Joshua, my great military leader. It wasn't all the men of Israel. It wasn't Moses and Aaron and Hur for their acts upon that hill. But it was God was his banner. And he was recognizing God's power. And through all this, God deserves the glory. Through all of his word and even today, God deserves all the glory, for all good things do come from him. So I'm seeing people line up back there. I think if we go back one more row, we should have plenty of room on this side for them.